Welcome everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Please, everybody, check your cell phones and make sure they're off or on silent mode. Before we say the Serenity Prayer together, let's share a moment of silence while thinking about why we're all here. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Our AA group believes in sponsorship. If you truly want to get sober, that's how it works. Do we have any visitors from other groups or out of town? Yes, hey.
I'm Steve. I'm a
college fanatic. Welcome, Steve. Well, we're glad you're here. Welcome, Chris. Yes, ma'am? Welcome, Elizabeth. Okay. Is there anybody who's never attended an AA meeting before? Not to embarrass you. First time?
First time.
All right. Well, you got to meet some of us, and hopefully stick around a little bit after it's over, and we'll mingle a little bit. It's going to be a good story tonight.
For sure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
AA story is a big part of AA's history. There's all kinds of meetings, discussion meetings, there's book studies, there's all kinds of fellowship. NABA has a speaker meeting one night a week on Monday nights. Other clubhouses may have them weekly or maybe monthly. Groups have speakers every once in a while. But it's a long, long tradition, so welcome.
Thank you.
You bet. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety. We have no dues or fees, but we do have self-supporting baskets, which will be passed while three friends come up to read how it works, the 12 traditions, and the promises. If you can contribute whatever you can to help our group meet rising expenses, it will be appreciated. The baskets will be passed till the reading of our 12 traditions. And Jim W. will get us started with how it works.
Hey, I'm Jim W. I'm alcoholic. It is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way that we used to be liked, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go any length to get it, then you're ready to take the certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at a turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Step 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to other human beings the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to all of them. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure themselves or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear these three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholics and we cannot manage our lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would. We were sought. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. I'll be reading the 12 traditions. Number 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Number 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
My name is Gator. These are the promises. I'm an alcoholic. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of usefulness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our own fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We'll suddenly realize God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
My name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So I get the gift to introduce Mike M. Mike is one of the guys who has come into my life over this past year. We've had the opportunity to start going through the book together, our basic text, and start doing the steps. Had some mutual relationships back up in New York City provided one of those moments where you say to yourself, is it odd or is it God? And in the time that I've been getting to know him, it's just one of these guys that hit a bottom and said I had enough. And I know a lot of his story, but I'm really looking forward to it again. He's one of those guys that you should get to know. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mike M.
Good evening, everyone. Mike M., an alcoholic. Sobriety date is September 6, 2011. So I just made my 7-year mark, and I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I have a home group, and I try to do service, but ironically enough, when I approached Tim about this group, I said, I really like coming here and I'd like to do service. And he said, well, I'll just get you on the speakers list. So there you go. The program works for me, and I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been extremely feeling very grateful lately about what the program has been able to deliver for me. I don't deserve the gifts that I've gotten from this program. I just need to say that, and I think I say that in a way that I feel humbled and grateful that I'm here, that I'm sober, and that I was able to keep or appreciate the things that are important to me now, like I haven't before. And I think, you know, it's taken me a while to kind of get to this point. And, you know, I'll just briefly go through kind of how I got here. But I think I'd like to spend a little bit of time just talking about what it feels like when you do get here. And then the gift of when you keep coming, what happens? Because that's kind of what I'm filled with tonight. And I told my sponsor I wasn't going to think about what I was going to say tonight. I'm just going to let it flow. So I just prayed on it. But let me just start kind of at the beginning. You know, for me, drinking, I was introduced to drinking around middle school. You know, binge drinking behind the, you know, the baseball diamond or in, you know, in fields with keggers and stuff. But I didn't really take to it. I didn't take to it mostly because I had a strict mom and dad, and there was I had to be in. Curfew was like essentially as soon as it hit dark, I had to be in, and most of my cool friends were drinking well after I'd have to go to bed. So it wasn't that I didn't try, I just didn't have enough time. The keg got tapped, it got dark, and I'd have to basically leave. So it wasn't for lack of attempts, but I just never really got pulled into the drinking scene until really my junior year in high school. And I was on the soccer team, and the soccer team, you know, we sucked, but we would drink after every game no matter what. And so we drank when the one set of the five games we'd win, and we drank every time we lost. And so there'd always be a keg at someone's house, and I'd get drunk there, and I enjoyed it. I knew it right away that it was what I, it helped me escape. I was always the guy that never really fit in the cliques that was the jocks or the smart guys. I always liked attention, negative attention, good, positive attention, didn't matter. But I didn't like myself. So I would drink to sort of escape my own thoughts. And I remember vividly that I never felt as loose or relaxed talking to girls or being able to tell a joke as long as I was buzzed. So I started to associate that feeling, removing the me being awkward with having my medicine. You know, I call alcohol my medicine. I never drank for taste. I always drank for effect. I wasn't particularly interested in beer, but I would drink it always for the effect. I didn't like the taste of it. But that's what I did, and I don't remember if I ever had a choice to just drink a beer. I would probably turn it down because it wasn't going to get me buzzed. And I just remember that being the case, looking back on it. So you know, really for me though, as I was getting to that point in, I had no realization that alcohol was a problem. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know about my family history of it, so I didn't know that I was going down a path that at all that was paved with disaster. So I just went off to college and did a significant amount of drinking. I was able to keep, you know, my grades in high school up, so I got into a good college. I stayed in college, but I would drink more and more. I would drink alone. So I would do, I don't know if you've all, this was like a Northeast thing, but Genesee Cream Ale. Anyway, it's horrendous beer, and it, you know, you get it by the, it would be like a case of it would come in a hard cardboard box that you could actually use as furniture. So I would like get three cases, and I would drink it over the next couple of weekends, maybe sometimes faster. But I always drink. I always start drinking alone. I drink like 12 by myself, and then I'd go out and drink. And so I'd start it like as soon as my last class was over. Then I started skipping class and making sure my last class on a Friday stopped at noon, so I could start earlier. But I was pretty much a solo drinker, and I would be pretty blitzed by the time like dinner came around. I would skip dinner and just go right to the party. Again, I didn't think there was any. I didn't really have any consequences in college. Ironically, I was on the. There's this honor board that you could be a part of. And I was studying to be a lawyer, so I said, "Well, I'll be on this honor board," and all of the honor board was about was, honoring the rules of the school, and you had to enforce them, and I would be drunk breaking every rule that I would be enforcing the next day. It was total hypocrisy, you know. That didn't strike me as a problem, and the fact that I could live two lives, one where I was sort of faking it, saying, well, I'm going to be a lawyer someday, and another one where I would be loaded, not remember what happened that night, and then wake up with like needing stitches, not having any idea of how that the two connected. So I would think I was fooling you, the rest of the world, to think that I was on my way to something good. And in the meantime, I was drinking to get drunk every weekend, and then sometimes on weekdays as well. So, I graduated college. Again, no real consequences from any of my actions as of this time. Went off to work in New York City for a couple of years, and I had I started having consequences in New York City. I would go out drinking, would get in bar fights. I would always be the guy that would start a fight, and I'd always be the first to fall. And it was like I just had a big mouth, and I couldn't back it up, and I just. Never got sort of arrested. I never got arrested for any of my drinking. I don't know how that happened. I'll tell you later. But I should have. Like, I was a reprobate. And I would always be the guy with the big mouth. And it was always designed to sort of like so you really couldn't figure out what my story really was. I would pretend to be this guy that liked to have fun. And but in any case, got out of, did work for a couple of years, then I went off to law school in Boston, and I really drank in earnest in law school. So I had learned how to drink really well in college and thought, well, I can do it. I got through school. I'll just stick to my drinking only on Fridays and Saturday nights and study on Sundays. And that's pretty much how I got through law school. I would drink till I couldn't remember where I was. Every Friday night, every Saturday night, I got through. I just basically just got through law school, there's this thing called law review, and the idea on the law review is you have to have certain grades, and then if you're good, you get a certain grade, you have to write a big paper, and then if you write well enough, they let you get on. And I should not have gotten on the law review, but. I remember the morning of the exam, I was still drunk, and you had to write a long paper, and then I just made it over the grade point level, and then you had to write a paper. And I remember being drunk, and I remember saying, I can't read my writing. There's no way I'm going to get through this. And every time I'd do this, I would pass in some form of abusing alcohol, and I would use it as an excuse of that it's not affecting my life. Right? People would say to me, you should probably tone down your drinking, but I never made the connection that there was a problem because in my mind, I was being rewarded for everything I did. I never saw the signals. So fast forward, I meet my wife actually in law school, my future wife in law school, and ironically, I was telling this the other day. You guys ever heard of Goldschlager? Yeah, so it's horrendous, right? I mean, it's gold flakes inside of a licorice-flavored drink. And the night I met my wife, I was, of course, loaded. It was the second day of my first my first day in law school, actually. And she was a second year. I was a first year. And some guy was buying her Goldschlager shots, and she was pushing them down the bar and handing them to me. And I was drinking and thinking, this lady's going to try to pick me up. And she was just trying to get rid of them. So the guy to her right would think she was drinking, but wasn't. She didn't know who I was. And ironic. And I thought she was all over me. I thought she was, this lady really likes me. This is going to work out well. So much so that the next day, hungover, dehydrated, I saw her in the hallway. And I walked up to her and I said, you know, thanks for buying me those drinks last night. And she's like, the hell are you? She didn't know what I was talking about. She literally was just pushing him away from the guy that was buying her to the right. So it's so funny. But we did. I didn't get a date out of it right after that. So that was good. And she's been the rock in my life. But so I get through law school again. Not. There wasn't a weekend I would not drink into oblivion. Again, no consequences in law school per se. There was an arrest in college, but it was a misdemeanor. So when you have to apply for the bar exam, you can't have a felony. And so I remember calling the lawyer that got me off this. I was dancing over a bridge and like in the middle of over the Hudson River, and I'm, you know, like half naked or whatever, and just being crazy. And I remember saying, is that a felony? Like, I don't know. So I called the lawyer, got me off, and he said, no, it's like a misdemeanor, buddy, you're okay. So I could apply for the New York bar. Anyway, I get through law school, get into the bar again, so feeling like there's nothing's going wrong in my life, but I was growing increasingly dependent on alcohol. So I would always be the first person at the bar. I'd always be the first person to start the happy hour. I'd always be one of the last people to leave. I couldn't always patch the night together. And that sort of continued for my first two or three years out of law school. And then I went in-house to an insurance company, and they moved me ultimately. I'm skipping forward now a couple of years because the drinking for me continued until I had my first kid. We had our first child. He was diagnosed with autism. And when I didn't know what autism was, I had to look it up. But I had, I remember being so blotto the night that I looked it up and, you know, read about it on WebMD. And I said, well, you know, this is like just the pity party began. And I remember going on like a 4 days of just drinking. In that point, my drink of choice was Mount Gay rum and tonic. And I would do one part Mount Gay, one part tonic, and I would polish off the bottle in a couple of days, you know, a big flask of it. But you know, essentially, I was drinking to hide my feelings. I was drinking to show you who I wanted you to think I was, and I was also drinking to prevent reality from sinking in. So now, I was essentially surrounding myself in drinking. It was my only therapy. So just sort of cut to the chase. I ended up, it started becoming a problem and consequences started to develop. My wife and I would fight a lot about my alcoholism. I'd have kids. I wouldn't show up for them. I'd be passed out. The kids were young. Toddlers were young. I wouldn't be able to attend to them. We had fights all the time. The fights were either about money or alcohol or some combination of that. And it didn't dawn on me. I always just said to me, as long as I continue to bring in a paycheck, you know, this is the part of my life I'm not going to give up. So it wasn't negotiable. But at that point, alcohol I'd become powerless. I started to see it, and the only thing that resonated with me was that, you know, my wife would look at me with the like disappointment. That sort of look, like, you know, this is not who I want to be with. And I remember that stuck with me. It didn't change the way I drank, by the way. It just stuck with me, and it made me feel worse. That's really what it was. Really sort of at this point, at one point in 2011, I moved down to New York City for a job. It was a promotion in New York City, and my wife was going to move down in about 4 months. So I'm down in New York City in a corporate apartment, And in New York City, where there's just the drinking scene is you can do whatever you want, anytime you want, with any substance you want. And I drank all the time. Every night, I would drink at least a bottle of wine with dinner. Expense accounted, so whatever. Gained like 20 pounds. And I was, but I was always under the influence. So I thought to, we had a Christmas party, and I remember this. You know, so I'm the chief lawyer for this particular group of in this New York City division, and they asked me to go to the Christmas parties to make sure that no one misbehaved. And I was the first to open the place. I was the only one who was two-fisting at the bar before everyone else was there. So I wanted to make sure that everyone thought I wasn't holding two drinks. I had to drink as soon as they opened the bar. And I remember at one point, like, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, I was going to an after party. I have no idea. People had told me later. And, you know, some lady tried to kiss me or something like that, and she got all mad because I said I didn't want to kiss her, and she made a big deal about it. She threw a chair at me. And, like, this was the sort of stuff, like, I'm, like, the general counsel, and this is how I'm behaving. Like, this is, I'm supposed to be watching people like me and see that they don't misbehave. So I've become the child. I'm the one who's out of control. And, you know, I remember saying after that, I won't drink. I'll stop drinking because now it's going to start having consequences. I just moved down here. I signed a contract. Like, I really need to make this, just really have to work out. And it turned out this woman who threw a chair at me, she worked at my office. I didn't even know that. So I thought for sure she's going to make a complaint and I'm done. Anyway, she didn't make a complaint. I don't know why. She was more drunk than I am. Maybe she doesn't remember. But I thought, you know, the worst thing is, like, my wife's going to find out and this is going to be enough to draw the line for her. She's not going to move down here. She's not going to want to be with a drunk like me. So I got to sober up. Well, that lasted about 2 days, and then I couldn't do it. I couldn't stop drinking. I never make good decisions when I was drunk, but I made the decisions that I wanted to make when I was drunk. I would get drunk to do things that I really wanted to do. And I take responsibility for that now. I used to say, I drank, I don't know what happened. No, I drank so that I could do things that I would be ashamed of later, but I really wanted to do. And that sort of, the powerlessness with the self-pity and the feeling that I didn't know how to stop, that all sort of came together. My family moved down. That's coming summer, my wife didn't want to be in New York City full time in the summer, so she went back to our in-laws' house in Rhode Island, and they had a boat. And I remember it was probably 10 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. The boat had enough room, you could put like 10 people on it, and it wasn't my boat, but I said, I'll be the captain. And then I had some Captain Morgan with me, and I decided to drink about, you know, 5 or 6 of those, take the boat out, all the kids are on the boat, and I'm going off to this back eddy area where we could all go tubing, and I hit a shoal on the beach and a clam bed, and the boat almost tips over, I broke the boat in a couple of places, and everyone knew I was drunk. But no one else knew how to ride, operate the boat. So I trapped everyone on the boat. I was drunk. Everyone knew I was drunk. The boat, someone else's problem, I thought. Well, you know, it was like a $15,000 worth of damage. And, you know, that was my boating while drunk. And, you know, I've been drinking and loaded for years and never caused any harm to anybody. So I thought, well, that's my wake-up call. Like, there's my God shot. Like, I will definitely stop drinking now. My wife threatened to leave me, and so now this was the summer of, this was June of 2011. I promised her I'd stop drinking, like I'd done all the times before. Lasted, I think it was like 5 days. I even went to my first AA meeting. This is sort of like this old Yankee kind of town, and everyone in this meeting was like, everyone had 20 years, I think. It was like, I was like the new guy, and everyone came flocking over to me because they finally had some new blood. It was probably the same 10 guys looking at each other for the last 10 years. And So everyone's like, oh, the new guy. And I'm like, yeah, it's Mike's my first one. So I grabbed my chip, and that was a five-day experience. I was back out. But then I would hide it from my wife. So then that became a new thing, whereas I have to hide. So now I knew it was wrong. I was powerless, but I couldn't stop, and I needed to keep my marriage together. So I'm just going to go ahead and drink secretly. So I used to, you know, drink vodka because you couldn't smell in your breath. And I'd come to bed and swear I wasn't drinking. My wife's like, you smell so bad. You know, like you're loaded. I'm like, I'm not loaded. We'd fight about the fact that I was drunk while I'm slurring my words in bed, smelling like rum or vodka. It's comical. And not comical. It's actually tragic. And so it was now August. We're coming back for the summer. And I get back on another boat. And I tell all the kids to go. They're not letting me pilot the boat, but I said, I'll watch the boat. I'll make sure it stays anchored. You all go into shore. We park next to shore, and kids all swam off a sandbar, and I'll watch the boat. And I proceeded to drink like 7 Mount Gay and tonics and jam the music up really loud, Jimmy Buffett, and start dancing on top of the top of the boat, on top of the cover of the boat, which is stupid and dangerous. And my brother-in-law swam back to the boat and said, are you all right? Like, you know, you're like, this is not good behavior. And I remember being got in a big fight. My wife, she got home. She wouldn't talk to me. And when we got home, brought the kids home, she said, you know, if you don't stop drinking, we're going to have to leave you. And she'd said that before, but she meant it. And she said, we are going to leave you. And so, like, I have my two kids who I love, my wife, and that hit me, and I said I would try to do it one more time. So I went back to that same meeting with the old Yankees and AA in this little church in Rhode Island, and it was amazing because they welcomed me back and they remembered my name. And I'd met them for like 3 minutes, and I was like, these guys are really weird. They're giving me a chip, they're handing me all these books, and I just want to get out of here. They remembered me, and I'll never forget that. That was my first time trying to not drink, and I meant it. And I knew I couldn't stop drinking by myself. I just didn't know exactly how to stop. I go back to New York City, and I can't seem to tie. I got about a month in, and my excuse was, well, I don't know any AA meetings in New York City, and I don't want to go with a bunch of drug addicts, and I lived on the Upper West Side, and I didn't know where to go. And I don't know if you've been in New York City, and there's like 400 AA meetings. Like, there was an AA meeting around every corner. Ironically, there was an AA meeting in the synagogue 2 blocks up from where I was, and it met like every day. But I couldn't find a meeting that I liked, so I made it for about a month, and I went back out for, you know, about a week drinking again. Hid it from my wife. And then I finally, on September 6th, 2011, I went to a meeting. I'd been to this meeting. I'd sort of stopped in and kind of did the drop-in in the back of the meeting and kind of left and assessing whether or not I should stick around. I'd always leave early. And I sat for the first time in the back and stayed. And afterwards, I met this guy, Daniel, who gave me his name and said his phone number and said, you know, he was a great guy. He was a guy that he would recite poetry. He was like a musician and a poet. He was a computer engineer. Like, he was this really deep guy. And he was, you know, when he spoke, he was like an AA Jedi. I didn't know he had a lot of time, but you could tell he had gone through a lot in his life. And he just gave me his card, a card, just from the AA meeting itself, and just said, call this guy, and he'll find you a sponsor. And I don't know what it was, because I had no intention of calling it, no intention of calling this number. I left, and I remember just like, I had not been a believer in God. I put God out of my life, and I remember just like praying, because I couldn't put days together, that maybe this is the call I need to make to stop. Maybe this is the next step I need to make. I know you need a sponsor to be able to stay in these rooms. I thought you kind of had to have a sponsor if you want to stick around AA. So I'm like, well, if I'm going to keep coming back, I have to have a sponsor. Like, this is what I thought. So I called. I got the name of my sponsor, my first sponsor, Jamil. Jamil walked me through my first step, my second step. Now I was up at September 6th. I had about 7 or 8 weeks in. And I don't know if you remember, at this point he told me I should be doing my 90 and 90. And I didn't want to put those 90 and 90 together. I said, well, I will, but I can't make it every day. So, you know, I'm really busy. I work downtown. I can't make it every day. So he said, we'll do 90 and 90 together. He goes, when do you get up? And I said, well, I get up early. I'm an early riser. He said, good. I live not too far from you. I'll meet you at this meeting. It starts at 6:30, the early risers on 96 and Broadway in the little room. The little room is like the little room is quite literally like these 12 seats. And we'd go to meetings together and we'd work the steps. At one point he introduced the 90-90 to me and I finally said, I'll do it. I kept putting it off. And then we had Superstorm Sandy came in to New York City and sort of leveled all of downtown Manhattan, which is where I worked. And my building, the water level had gotten up to the entranceway to the lobby is 18 feet high, and the water level got up to 18 feet. And then it sort of, the building was condemned for like, and this is where I think God definitely came in. So I now ran out of an excuse to not go to that meeting in the morning because I couldn't go back to work. And I was out of work for 90 days. Like, the building was shut down for 90 days. So there goes my excuse. And I did do the 90-90, by the way, with absolutely no thank God for that. Because by, like, the 90th day, I was listening to what people were saying and not what they looked like, and not that they were really an addict and I really wasn't, and they had a really hard bottom and I didn't, I don't belong. I stopped comparing a little less. And I started listening a little bit more. And I think it's that time. I think that was God's gift to me. I believe that's why I stuck through those first 90 days, because they were hairy days. So let's just quickly move. That's sort of my story. I've been able to stay sober. And I think I'm so blessed. And I think I want to just focus on sort of what about the program has worked for me I needed to find fellowship. After a meeting, I needed to find fellowship. I would be the guy in New York when I had a meeting, I had a home group, but I would check out as soon as the meeting was done. I wouldn't go out afterwards. So I never had a chance, other than with my sponsor, to talk to other people who were dealing with AA and the problems of alcoholism, dealing with their alcoholism in different ways. I had no group that I could relate to, and I think that hurt me. I know it hurt me. And so the fellowship I did not find, I think, until my fourth year of sobriety. I decided to actually try something different. And it was in my fourth year, I think, that I'd done the steps once at this point, but I had missed the fellowship and I didn't do any 12-step work. And I think giving the program back was the difference with me. I was more focused on not drinking and staying away from drinking and just getting to a meeting, but I wasn't focused on the fact that the meeting is full of people and there are people outside of the program that need your help. And the only way to stay in the meeting is to be helping people outside the meeting. And I didn't put that together. But in my fourth year, I started to do service. I had a home group. I was a greeter. I was treasurer. And, you know, I started to give back. And that amazing part of that for me was that was the program finally, like, I was breathing the program in and breathing it out. Before that, I was just taking. I was taking, grabbing, and not giving back. And the thing about that was ironic is I thought, well, I'm getting my medicine. But I'd heard everyone say that, you know, the only way your program's going to work is if you're giving it back. It finally resonated with me because I'm really stubborn. I need to usually stick my finger in the sock to know there's electricity in it. I don't really want to believe what you say. I have to test everything. And so I would say that the biggest part of my program has been that has kept me sober is my relationship with God. And I think for me, that's always been a rough part. I grew up kind of a lapsed Catholic, and I had a bad relationship with religion. As soon as I could stop going to church, I stopped going. I blamed most of my problems on God, except when I was in a lot of trouble, in which case I would ask for a favor. But for the most part, God was not a friend of mine. And, you know, it's interesting. I think when I've been able, I pray for grace every morning. And I, for years in the program, like, I didn't feel any better. Like, it mentally, the first 4 years or so, I stopped drinking. I stopped having the effects of drinking. And my life stayed together. But I was missing something. And you know, I was doing some reading in the Big Book at the time. I remember it was like, this is like now, I'm running my fifth anniversary. And I said, I need grace. Like, I don't have grace. I don't have the belief that things are going to be okay. I don't really turn things over. I just don't think about them. And so I started the practice of trying. I also used psychologists to help me, and medication that's prescribed by a psychiatrist to sort of try to get my fear and anxiety under control. And I think the combination of meditating that I learned from my sponsor and then taking a deep breath and allowing, realizing that I can't control anything that happens in my life, that things are going to happen and I need to allow them to happen and try to figure out what the next right thing to do is. That yielding control for me was the hardest part of my sobriety. And I refused to turn over my life to AA. And I think in the right around that fifth year, they say that's when you kind of get your marbles. It dawned on me that that's what I needed to do. I need to figure out something different than what I was doing. And I moved to New Hampshire after New York City, and one of the things different about that move, and that was 2016 July 15th. I moved there with my family, and the first Saturday that I could, we moved in on a Friday. The Saturday morning, I went to a meeting. I raised my hand. I found some elder-looking dude, and I said, "I need a sponsor." And he said, "No problem." I joined that group. That became my home group. It was a men's group, and I got involved quickly. And it was the best thing I did. It was because it taught me that basically you can start the fellowship and you can start service right away. Like, you don't have to wait. You don't have to feel out the program. Made all the difference in the world. So I have great friends now that are, you know, sober friends. We have a lot of fun together on the weekends. I live in New Hampshire on the weekends, and I work in Atlanta during the week. Just for work. It seemed to be the best thing professionally for me. But here too, I've got great friends in the program. I've got a great sponsor. I try to keep the program fun, and the best way to do that is just be around people that you want to be around that are in the program. You know, the only other thing I would suggest is try to make meetings as much as you possibly can. Make as many as you can a week, only because for me it's my medicine. You know, just the if I don't go to a meeting, if I miss two or three meetings in a week, it shows. It absolutely shows. I cannot make it. I will not be the same person at the end of a week with no meetings. I need to be reminded, because I forget often, you know, that I'm an alcoholic in the way I think. I guess what I'd say in closing is just, you know, I, I have so many blessings in my life right now. I was able to keep my family together. My wife loves me, so she says. We had a great weekend together away in Beaufort County, South Carolina. Had a great time in the Low Country, hanging out at a beautiful resort. And, you know, she held my hand the whole time we were there. We were like a young couple again. And she said, you know, it was only a few years ago, she said, that she began to trust me again after all the lies I told her about my drinking. And I just think I'm just grateful that she's in my life, that I have wonderful children that I can, I appreciate. I try to honor them in a way that I didn't before. I try to live with grace is what I'm trying to say, I guess. And I'm very blessed. I guess that's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I didn't know you were a commuter.
Wow.
That is some dedication. I'm glad you made it here tonight. But he's here most every Monday night. Yes, for the last year. Yeah. Well, Tinsley, would you mind doing some heavy lifting here?
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Mike. That was a great story. I could really relate to it. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life, one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? For 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days? A red chip for 90 days? Does anybody have 6 months for a yellow chip? Does anybody have 9 months for a green chip? Any birthdays? 1 year or multiples? Would anybody like to reconsider on a white chip? Free yourself. Big hand for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Tinsley. Good work. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight. Finishing, we'll take a brief period for AA and NABA Club announcements. Who will get us started? Tim?
I'm Tim, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Yeah. You need an attendance sheet signed, detaining while you're on the end. We'll be glad to give you our autograph with your attendance sheet, too. If anybody came in later or missed the passage, I'll have a basket up on the front desk. We appreciate you.
Thanks, Tim. And next week, Kelly R. of the Alpharetta Group will be telling her story. And then the week after that, Carla S. S. of the Happiness Group at 8111. So, and Mark, yeah.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. Mark. Well, hey, Mark. I have a key to literature cabinet. Anyone like in 80s literature, see me after the meeting.
Okay. Get your literature from Mark after the meeting. Okay. If there are no further announcements, I remind each of you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join hands in the Lord's Prayer. Who grants us serenity?
Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever.
Amen.
Keep coming back.
All right.
Okay.
Hey Tim, ask Vaughn if you'll come back and speak for us, won't you? No? What's it been, about 5 or 6 years now?
What's that?
It's been about 6 or 7 years, eh?
Good while.
Yeah. Would you consider coming back?
Huh?
Would you consider coming back?
Yeah, I would, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. He knows how to get.
I think I still got your number. Let me see.
We'll probably think and probably have an open mail date for November or December.
Give it to me. Give it to me, Mom.
678-772-6314. Mark, how you doing, buddy?
678-772-6314.
I just keep them in there.
Oh, you keep them in there.
Yeah, I borrowed them from the early morning study group. So far, I've been getting away with it.
Okay. They don't run out.
I think they got more than they need.
It's hard to say. That meeting has gone up and down.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know where it's at now. I haven't been in a while. I used to go off.